Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Hornets 1. A new lease. Ladies and gentlemen from New Orleans, where we're celebrating the lease, you know? Isn't that what the game is all about? Getting the best lease? In case you're one of those folks who has been induced by the rhetoric surrounding the European financial crisis to point a finger at Greece for being so perverse, so profligate, so pusillanimous, and we'll continue with the P words shortly on this broadcast, this might illuminate. It's from Der Spiegel. Yeah, I know. The kid threw it in the pool again today. But anyway, European countries are expected to implement tough austerity measures during the debt crisis, reports Der Spiegel. Germany isn't setting a very good example. Der Spiegel has learned that Germany failed to reach its own austerity goals last year. And despite pressuring its neighbors to save, Germany is behind this year, too. Angela Merkel's, she's the Chancellor of Germany, constant mantra as she travels around Europe in recent months has been austerity. But she hasn't been quite as strict when it comes to her own country's budget. Spiegel reports this week the German government didn't reach even half of its planned savings in the federal budget. Only 42% of the spending cuts proposed by Merkel's coalition government were actually implemented.
Do as I say, not as I do.
That wasn't a German accent. What are you kidding me? Ladies and gentlemen, the Iraq War was a mistake, the biggest strategic error since Vietnam. Now, that's not me saying that. Well, it was me saying it because I'm sitting here at the microphone. But those are the words of R. Nicholas Burns.
Yes, Mr. Burns.
Who was Undersecretary of State, the third most senior officer in the State Department, during the George W. Bush administration. In a much-ignored article in Politico this week, he was interviewed. He cited, among other issues, the many thousands of Americans and Iraqis killed, the high cost, both political, the tremendous damage to our image in the Arab world, and financial. A recent comprehensive academic study put the actual cost of both Iraq and Afghan wars at, you know, $4.4 trillion, give or take a trillion. The war, I know it's over, but its consequences continue. Says the Politico article, every day since American troops pulled out, the situation on the ground seems to go bleaker. A former United Nations officer who worked there during the war offered this view. Quote, we're now at the nadir politically, no question about it. A few days later, Iraqi's vice president, hiding out in Kurdistan because the prime minister wants to arrest him, proclaimed on television that his bodyguards and other employees are being held in secret prisons and tortured. The new Iraq, ladies and gentlemen. The Nation, says Joel Brinkley, former foreign correspondent for the New York Times, writing in Politico, the Nation of Iraq seems to be relapsing rapidly into brutal dictatorship. There's an incredible consolidation of power in the executive, says Jason Gluck of the United States Institute of Peace. Oh, good luck to you, baby. During the war, he worked in Iraq for the National Democratic Institute. We won't even go into that. The parliament has been rendered extremely feeble, he says Mr. Gluck, with little ability to stand up to the executive. Well, wasn't that the democracy they were aping in the United States under the Bush administration? I didn't see a lot of ability to stand up to the executive. They were good students, see? Washington has lost nearly all ability to influence events there. Prime Minister Maliki seems little interested in anything the U.S. has to say. Our ambassador has only been able to meet with Maliki twice since December, despite repeated attempts. So the State Department is going to slash its Baghdad embassy staff by half. because most diplomats and other workers find themselves confined to the embassy, unable to accomplish much, if anything, even though we built the largest embassy in the universe to house them. Human Rights Watch last month said it found a secret prison whose jailers report to Maliki's office inside hundreds of political prisoners, Maliki rivals, are tortured with impunity. Impunity is one of those electric guns, I believe. Despite U.S. government assurances it helped create a stable democracy, Human Rights Watch says the reality is it left behind a budding police state. So we replaced an entrenched and competent police state with a budding and bumbling one. Job well done, everyone. Hello, welcome to the show.
Baby, there's a fire starting in my heart, reaching a fever pitch, it's bringing me out of the dark. Finally I can see you crystal clear. Go ahead and sell me out, I'll lay your ship bare. The scars of your love remind me of us, they keep me thinking that we almost had it all. The scars of your love, they leave me breathless, can't help feeling we could have had it all. Rolling in the deep, you had my heart inside your hand, you know you played it to the beat. You know you played it to the beat. Baby, I have no story to be told. I've heard one of you, I'm gonna make your head burn. Think of me in the depths of your despair, making a home down there, this mine sure won't be shared. The scars of your love, they remind me of us, they keep me thinking that we almost had it all. The scars of your love, they leave me breathless, I can't help thinking we could have had it all. Rolling in the deep, you had my heart inside your hand, you know you played it. Scars of your love leave me breathless, I think we almost had it all. Scars of your love remind me of us, they keep me thinking. Scars of your love remind me of us, keep me thinking that we almost had it all. Scars of your love, they leave me breathless, I can't help thinking could have had it all. Rolling in the deep, you had my heart inside your hand, and you played it, played it, played it, played it to the beat. Oh, you know that you played it, you know you played it to the beat. You know you played it to the beat. We could be rolling. We could be rolling, rolling. We could be rolling, rolling. We could be rolling, rolling, rolling. We could be rolling deep.
From the edge of Lake Pontchartrain in New Orleans, Louisiana, I'm Harry. We won the lease. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, news of the Olympic movement. produced by Jim Ebersole Jr. As the days grow short, well, the same length days, but the number of days grows short, until the Olympics are upon us, the news of the Olympic movement grows more numerous in story, content, and count.
What?
Here we go, ladies and gentlemen. An annual survey of hotel room prices has found that visitors to London will pay twice as much to stay as last year. Those are Olympic prices. A study by Hotels.com found prices for booking in March this year for August are 102% higher than for the same months last year. So, you're welcome. It's a movement. But wait, there's so much more. London Olympics organizers are being criticized for obsessive secrecy after declining to give local politicians a breakdown of the number of tickets sold at what price until the games are over. We've shared that with you in previous weeks. The British government has rejected advice from the Olympic team's top doctor that athletes should not shake hands at the London Games to avoid germs that could make them sick. That was what the doctor said. But the British government says, go ahead, shake. Government health advisors seem perplexed by the guidelines, which Olympic hopefuls derided as rude and pointless. And now the British Olympic Association has softened its no-handshake stance. The athletes will be able to greet the 10,000 visiting Olympians and hundreds of dignitaries with handshakes. They'll just have to make sure they wash thoroughly right after. Pardon me, Mr. President, I have to go wash. The London Games have so far failed to convince the public of their sustainability legacy, according to new research commissioned by General Electric. Despite London 2012 being dubbed the greenest ever Games, 6 months away, only 5% of UK consumers believe the Games will improve the country's green credentials or reduce environmental impact. The study finds that 12% of Brits believe the Olympics will leave behind sustainable technologies for the wider society to inherit. They're in stark contrast, these findings of the public poll, with the views of sustainability, energy, and construction experts interviewed for the same report, who see the showcasing and wider deployment of sustainable technologies as the true legacy of the Olympics. All right, we'll see. Olympics Minister Hugh Robertson has entered a row over plastic Brits by saying every athlete representing the British team at the London 2012 Games should know the words to the national anthem. American-born hurdler Tiffany Porter, who has opted to represent Britain despite living in the USA all her life, was challenged to say the words of God Save the Queen after being named as British team captain for the gymnastics athletics indoor world championships. Porter, who has dual nationality via her British mother, said she did know the first lines of the anthem. And the 5,000-meter star Mo Farah branded the question unacceptable. Other athletes drafted into the British team last year include Cuban-born triple jumper Yamile Aidama. Well, there are others, too. Robertson insists there should be no fast-tracking of foreign-born athletes into the British team simply because they might win medals, and those who are accepted have to know the words of God Save the Queen. And last summer, 5 years after London was chosen to host the Games and less than 12 months before the start of the Olympics, the organizing committee realized it had totally underestimated the number of staff needed for security. This reporting The Guardian, this set off a panic in the government as ministers and mandarins in the cabinet office Olympic security meetings digested the bad news. Instead of 10,000 staff at the venues, the committee stated at least 20,000 would be needed and probably more. And the committee was not entirely sure where these extras would come from. The Metropolitan Police could not help. The force had enough to cope with. Senior officers could not resist muttering, I told you so in private. It wasn't as if they weren't warned, said one. The private security company G4S, which had the contract to train and provide venue security guards, volunteered to step in, but at a cost the organizing committee did not want to pay. So all eyes in the British government fell upon the military, stretched to the limit by Afghanistan and Libya, bruised by budget cuts, officials dug in. At the Defense Department, reluctantly they offered 2,000 to 3,000 soldiers and more in reserve, wanting assurances the department would not have to bear any extra costs. Another 4 months of negotiations inside the government before an agreement was reached. Every time we met, they seemed to want more troops, said a defense ministry official. At one point, the Treasury asked if the military could just do the whole job. But this was far from ideal, the source inside the defense ministry continues. Nobody quite knows how they got the numbers so wrong. The Home Office's permanent secretary, Dame Helen Gauche, admitted to a parliamentary committee that the original figure for security needs at the Olympics was, quote, only a finger in the air. One senior London 2012 insider blamed the organizing committee for taking too long to hire a director of security. Sir Ian Johnston, former chief constable with the British Transport Police, was recruited 4 years after the bid was won. The organizing committee says the detailed planning could never have been done until the venues were finished, but 2012 insiders said the security numbers revealed a blind spot. The original numbers were based on the Commonwealth Games in Manchester in 2002. Never destined to be an accurate comparison. Officials on the Olympic board believe the rationale of leaving recruitment of the security staff until the last minute proved a false economy. News of the Olympic movement. The Olympics. It's a movement, and we all need one. Every day. All right, enough of that. Ladies and gentlemen, now news of the new F-bomb, foreclosure. Our friend of this show, Eve Smith, whom we've heard on this broadcast, she's been remarkably accurate in terms of what she said months ago that has been, in the intervening time, vindicated by judges and, as you'll see in a moment, inspectors general. But here's Eve, who was on this show talking about the mortgage foreclosure settlement reached by the administration and state attorneys general a few weeks ago. Here's her latest on that subject. She says, remember that the administration also trumpeted that enforcement would be tough. The servicing standards allow for the astonishing concept, however, of an acceptable error rate. Banks aren't permitted to make errors with your checking account, and they ding you, with your checking account and ding you an accidental $10,000 and get away with it. But with people's most important asset, their homes, servicers, which are the bank subsidiaries that actually take your monthly payments, servicers are allowed a certain level of reportable errors. And by the way, the definition of reportable excludes a lot of errors. And many of them can be serious as far as borrowers are concerned. This is one example. Adherence to customer payment processing. According to column C of the actual text of the mortgage settlement released this week, it's not a reportable error for the banks to tell their computers that you paid less than you did. If amounts are understated by either $50,000 or 3%, whichever is greater. So, if you do the math, if your mortgage payment is $2,000 a month, 3% is $60. So what if you start facing fees? What if you're trying to bring your account current and the bank screws up the data entry and starts foreclosing? Why isn't that potentially devastating error reportable? And it gets worse because of column D. Reportable error has to happen 5% of the time to matter. There are more than 50 million mortgages in the country. 5% of 50 million is 2.5 million. In a single year, the banks can tell their computers that 2.5 million people paid so much less on their then they did, in fact, pay that it's reportable error, and still the bankers will not get in trouble. Bankers can tell 2.5 million people in short, hey, you didn't make your payment this month, your check's short, and we're putting it in the no-man's land of a suspense account triggering delinquency and fees, even though you really did pay in full and have the canceled check to prove it. Wrongful foreclosures at a 1% rate are acceptable under the settlement. 33,000 erroneous foreclosures since 2008 would be perfectly okay as far as the authorities who okayed the settlement are concerned. And Dr. Lan Pham, a former senior staffer, financial economist for the Congressional Budget Office, was fired from that organization for her attempts to quantify the economic implications of foreclosures and foreclosure fraud. The CBO rejected her analysis and even dismissed the notion that foreclosures cause negative impacts on the economy. The letter was just released publicly this week. Her letter to Senator Charles Grassley, making her allegations about the CBO. She said at the time, her time at the CBO, which barely lasted 3 months, made her doubt the accepted view that that body gives nonpartisan, dispassionate analysis of economic and budgetary issues. Alternative viewpoints are suppressed and questioned, often by the director of the Congressional Budget Office, Doug Elmendorf. Specifically, she wrote repeatedly about banking and mortgage issues in October 2010. I was repeatedly pressured by the CBO assistant director in charge of financial analysis not to write or discuss issues in the banking sector and mortgage markets that might suggest weakness in these sectors and their consequences on the economy and on households, she writes. She also says that statements could not be made attributing the decline in property revenues to foreclosures and the decline in home prices, which runs counter to common sense and findings by the Joint Economic Committee. Foreclosures had no impact on home prices. This runs counter to common sense and a prominent national home price index by CoreLogic in the CBO's key database. The decline in prices had home prices had no impact on household wealth, was the House party line inside the CBO. So, the new F-bomb destroying more in its wake all the time. New F-bomb foreclosure, ladies and gentlemen. And now,
here it is.
Here it all is. The apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Who isn't, really, when you stop to think about it? Well, administrators at a predominantly white suburban Detroit high school have apologized for disturbing class-oriented chants aimed at a largely African-American high school during the team's Class A regional semifinal game this week. Based on the demographics of both schools and the chanting involved, the incident was considered covertly racist by many fans of the school victimized by the chants. As reported by the Detroit News, Warren De La Salle High fans launched into chants of "We've Got Futures" and "Flip Our Burgers" when facing Detroit, Michigan King High. The chants began in the second half as King began to pull away from an overmatched De La Salle squad, which ultimately lost 72-50. "We are sorry," De La Salle athletic director Brian Kelly told the Detroit News. "We are embarrassed. I'm sending a letter of apology and congratulations to King. We are talking about kids being stupid, not a school's culture." Nice that you call your kids stupid. That's classy. The president of the University of Southern Mississippi has apologized for a derogatory chant made by members of the Golden Eagles pep band during an NCAA tournament game against Kansas State on Thursday. The phrase, "Where's your green card?" could be heard being chanted from the crowd before Wildcats freshman Angel Rodriguez, who was born in Puerto Rico and is a U.S. citizen, shot 2 free throws. The game was broadcast nationally, and clips were posted on True TV. "We deeply regret the remarks made by a few students at today's game, Southern Miss President Martha Saunders said. "The words of these individuals do not represent the sentiments of our pep band, athletic department, or university. We apologize to Mr. Rodriguez and will take quick and appropriate disciplinary action against the students involved in this isolated incident." The band director put a stop to the chant, and nobody at Southern Miss at that university called their students stupid. What's wrong with them? Norwegian police have apologized for delays in their response to the massacre of 69 young people by right-wing extremist Anders Behring Breivik last July, admitting that lives could have been saved if they'd intervened more quickly. On behalf of the Norwegian police, I want to apologize that we did not arrest him sooner, said the National Police Commissioner in a statement released with a report that evaluated the incident. Every minute was a minute too long. It is hard knowing that so many lives could have been spared if the perpetrator had been arrested sooner. Breivik goes on trial next month. Deadline Tokyo. Tokyo Electric Power President Toshio Nishizawa visited Fuke Governor Yuhei Sato this week and apologized for the accident at the Fuke nuclear power plant just before the first anniversary, so that was last week. Nishizawa showed TEPCO's intention to steadily address issues of maintaining shutdown, decommissioning, and compensating. We will make our best effort to carry out the restoration and rehabilitation of the citizens' treasured hometowns, he said. It is my hope that TEPCO will sincerely respond to the needs of the areas not targeted for compensation, said the governor. Yeah, good luck. Back to universities. Penn State planned to honor Joe Paterno's contract, allow him to continue as a tenured faculty member, and name him head coach emeritus after firing him over the Jerry Sandusky sex abuse scandal. But a new report says trustees never got to tell Paterno he was being dismissed as head coach because he ended a phone call after being informed he was not... couldn't inform him of his continued status because he ended a phone call after being informed he was no longer head coach. The trustees apologized for the unfortunate way we had to deliver the news to Paterno, who died 2 months ago. Rolling Stones guitarist Keith Richards has apologized to Mick Jagger for derogatory comments he made about Mick in the 2010 memoir Life, which caused a rift within the band. In comments reported by Rolling Stone, the two rock and roll veterans agreed it was time to move on, since there are plans to celebrate the Stones' 50th anniversary with a world tour next year. That might be appropriate, don't you think? Looking back at any career, you're bound to recall both the highs and the lows. Jagger was quoted as saying, in the 1980s, for instance, Keith and I were not communicating very well. I got very involved with the business side of the Stones, mainly because I felt no one else was interested. But it's plain now from the book that Keith felt excluded, which is a pity. Time, I reckon, to move on. That doesn't sound like rock and roll, does it? Well, it sounds like a band, but that doesn't sound like Mick, the street-fighting man. Richards added, Mick's right. He and I have had conversations over the last year of a kind we've not had for an extremely long time, and that has been incredibly important to me. As far as the book goes, it was my story, and it was very raw, as I meant it to be, but I know that some parts of it and some of the publicity really offended Mick, and I regret that. I'm thinking Stones on Oprah. No, the show. The band on the show. Don't get... St. Louis police have offered an apology to members of a North St. Louis church after they arrested the church's organist for a suspected theft and possession of drug paraphernalia during the service. The man wanted by the police was the organist, who was taking a break in Zion Temple's cafeteria on Sunday morning when two police officers arrested him. The sounds of the arrest were easily heard by church members through the collapsible wall and shocked the members inside, who were worshiping at the time. Don't give the organist a break. The name of a new Nike sneaker has people upset in Ireland. The footwear giant accidentally insulted the Irish while trying to honor the country leading up to St. Paddy's Day. Or St. Link's Day. The Nike SB Black and Tan Quick Strike is named after a black and tan colored alcoholic beverage made by mixing stout and lager, usually Guinness and Harp, in a pint glass. Even though Guinness and Harp are Irish, it is not a drink that's commonly requested in Irish bars. But in the 1920s, a British military paramilitary group known as the Black and Tans used brutality to suppress an armed Irish revolution. It was known for its ruthless attacks on civilians. Nike issued an apology for inadvertently upsetting people in Ireland, saying no offense was intended. Nike says the official name of the sneakers is Nike SB Dunk Low. And the shoes were unofficially named by some using a phrase that could be viewed as inappropriate and insensitive. By the way, speaking of the word inappropriate, it was the only word used this week by the Pentagon to explain their almost week-long delay in naming the Army staff sergeant who allegedly carried out the shooting of 16 unarmed civilians in Afghanistan. It would be inappropriate to release his name. Then they did. So now it's appropriate. But when you want to know what's appropriate or not appropriate, ask the Pentagon. French President Nicolas Sarkozy has apologized to a policewoman after his son threw a tomato at her. Teenage boy Louis Sarkozy and a friend chucked a tomato and a pellet at the policewoman from the Élysée Palace, police sources said. The president later reportedly met the officer and conveyed the apologies. Louis is Sarkozy's son from his second marriage. He has two other sons from his first marriage and a daughter with his new wife, Carla Bruni. How is he supposed to keep track? One might well ask. But he's French. That's how. And finally, ladies and gentlemen, because there, as one correspondent this week averred, there must be an end to the apologies. James Murdoch made a last-ditch appeal to a parliamentary committee investigating phone hacking at his company ahead of a report expected from the committee in the coming weeks that could determine whether he has a future in Britain. The letter to the parliamentary committee, he apologized in it to those affected, but said he'd been let down by senior staff. I see. It's an apology with a finger point on whom he had relied, allowing a scandal to escalate, which damaged not only the reputation of News Corp, or Nice Corp, as we call it, but also British politicians and police. I did not know about, nor did I try to hide wrongdoing, Murdoch said in the letter published by the committee, whilst, he was born in this country, but he's going to say whilst to them, whilst I accept my share of responsibility for not, I bet he doesn't know the words to the God Save the Queen either. That should be their first question to him if they call him back. Whilst I accept my share of responsibility for not uncovering wrongdoing sooner, I did not mislead Parliament, and the evidence does not support any other conclusion. By the way, this all revolves around an email that James was sent in 2008, which purported to warn him that the damage inside the News of the World, the now shuttered tabloid newspaper, was greater. The extent of phone hacking specifically was greater than they were then saying. They were saying it was one rogue reporter. And his latest excuse for why he didn't take the email to heart, he'd said all along he hadn't read the whole email. He now gives a little more detail about that. He said he got the email on a Saturday when I was most likely alone with my children. That's the quote. When I was most likely alone with my children. When I was probably doing something else. When I probably forgot. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And while we're at it, news of Nice Corp. Nice people doing nice things. Well, if you read the history of the Times of London, published by the Times of London, Rupert Murdoch maintained, and the history supported him in this, that there had never been a meeting between Rupert Murdoch and Maggie Thatcher before Murdoch was allowed to buy the Times and the Sunday Times newspapers, despite the fact he already owned a couple of newspapers in Britain. It wasn't even sent to the Monopolies Commission or the antitrust authorities as the law specified it should have been. Well, this week, Maggie Thatcher's papers were made public. And what do you know? She did have a secret meeting with Rupert Murdoch. And the former editor of the Sunday Times and the Times, Harry Evans, says, the whole thing is so squalid, I don't know whether to laugh or cry. Because he had said all along, the only way Murdoch could have avoided the planned purchase going before the Monopolies Commission is if somebody high up in government had intervened. It was highly improper, said Evans, for the Prime Minister to meet one of the bidders for Times newspapers. He noted the obvious disgust, the opening paragraph of the note to Thatcher from her press secretary with details of her discussion with Murdoch. Quote, in line with your wishes, the attached has not gone outside number 10, the Prime Minister's office, and is, of course, to be treated commercial in confidence. But the history of the Times lied. How could that be? James Murdoch, of whom we spoke moments ago, will leave the board of Sotheby's auction house following demands that he resign over his role in the phone hacking scandal. Says Charlie Beckett, director of the Media Institute at the London School of Economics of James Murdoch, his career is very much on hold. All right, then. Let's have some on hold music for James's career. Your career is important to us, James. Murdoch has already resigned this year from the board of GlaxoSmithKline and is executive chairman of News International, part of Nice Corp. Please stay on the line, James. A Nice Corporation spokeswoman declined to comment on the Sotheby's departure. CTW Group, an advisor to union-sponsored pension funds, it's the unions, with more than $200 billion in assets, sought the dismissal of Murdoch because of his handling of the phone hacking scandal. The scandal makes Murdoch ill-suited for service on those boards, CTW said in January. I could have asked more questions, requested more documents, and taken a more challenging and skeptical view of what I was told, Murdoch told the parliamentary committee this week. In this case, the approach fell short. But it's important to note that I did not turn a blind eye. Doesn't that sound like Ira Glass? We'll get to that. Thanks for holding, James. Your career is now hung up on. Nice Corporation's News of the World tabloid hacked into a priest's voicemail message to get scoops about British pop star Charlotte Church and her family. And Rupert is facing a fresh challenge to his UK media business as it emerged. Britain's communications regulator has escalated its probe into whether British Sky Broadcasting, which owns Sky channels in Britain, is a fit and proper owner of a broadcasting license. And it may not be fit and proper, but they're nice. Nice Corp. Yeah, they nice. They nice to all. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is a story that you probably did hear elsewhere in the media, unlike a lot of the stuff on this broadcast. The news that former U.S. Vice President Cheney has canceled an April appearance in Toronto, or as they say up there, Toronto, citing concerns that Canada is too dangerous. Quote, he felt that in Canada the risk of violent protest was simply too high. That's the quote from Ryan Ruppert, president of promotions company Spectre Live, which had booked Cheney for an April 24th appearance in Toronto. Last September, Cheney was speaking at a private club in Vancouver when protesters massed outside the front door harassing ticket holders and in one instance choking a security guard. The former vice president was reportedly held inside the building for more than 7 hours as Vancouver police in riot gear dispersed the demonstrators. Ticket holders can either bring in their tickets for a refund or go to a replacement talk by author Mark Stein. Dick Cheney, Mark Stein, I don't know. Yeah, same diff. So, yes, Canada is too dangerous for Dick Cheney. More details follow.
Next, intimate tales of America's former underground vice president. The action-packed diary of a man who was just a heartbeat away from history.
Dick Cheney, confidential.
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 Springtime. Like winter, summer, and fall, I used to think it was nothing special. But after a lifetime of life-saving procedures, I treasure spring. It's a time of new shoots, and more importantly, new shooters. Life in the post-book promotion period had settled into an amiable routine. Breakfast, Limbaugh, lunch, Hannity, dinner, O'Reilly, and off to bed. But as Lynn has so often told me, each heartbeat you borrow from God is getting you closer to the day when everybody realizes you were right. If that's true, God, I owe you. Because just before the robin started singing like chorus girls in the drunk tank, I got a love letter of my own from one of my new admirers, the Democrat Attorney General. Oh, it wasn't addressed to me in particular, but when he stood up at a law school and defended the unitary executive's power to kill American citizens overseas, I felt a swelling in my heart that was most likely not attributable to Lynn's turkey loaf. Now, I am no shrinking violet on my worst days, but hearing Eric Holder redefine due process as not having to involve judges, it got me harder than frozen spam. So I was suffusing the new, thinner me with a standard portion of self-confidence when I happened to notice my upcoming speaking schedule. It had been sparse during the wintertime. My agent said that folks didn't necessarily feel motivated these days to brave a snowstorm to see a former vice president in person. Now things were picking up, and that was fine by me. The Ritz-Carlton people had long since gotten the knack of the perfect turkey loaf. But one booking on the schedule filled me with the kind of dread I hadn't felt since I saw Paul Wolfowitz in the White House sauna. My speaking agent, Crawford Caton, was going over the spring bookings during a visit to the secured, undisclosed living arrangement. He was an East Coast WASP of the old school. And school was about to be out. Monday, 4:17 p.m.
So, and then there's a signing at the Thunder Bay Borders bookstore.
Mm-hmm. They still have Borders?
It's Canada. They still have newspapers.
Jesus. Okay. Thunder Bay is where?
North of Toronto. Suburban. Highly secure.
Mm-hmm. Ethnics?
Jewish neighborhood.
Our Jews are theirs.
Excuse me?
You know. Elliot Abrams and Bill Kristol. Or John Stewart and Rosie O'Donnell.
Well, I can't be sure, but I don't think she's Jewish.
But if she were, she'd be theirs.
Well, I'll check on the neighborhood. But they draw from a wide area. Usually our signings go very well there.
I'm not sure, Crawford. Mm-hmm. Something smells bad up there.
Oh, probably the cod sandwiches. I avoid them like the plague. Now, the next day, you go down to Toronto to appear on This Evening Tonight, which is the CBC's prime-time public affairs discussion program.
What the hell is that?
CBC, it's the national semi-public broadcast.
No, my friend, what's a prime-time public affairs discussion program? You mean a talk show?
Yep.
My God, they probably spell program with two M's and an E.
That they do. Mm. But it's a smart panel program. They have call-ins, very lively, very Canadian.
Crap. I can just imagine.
Good evening, and welcome to This Evening Tonight. I'm your host, Nash Hudson. Joining us for his first live Canadian television interview since the Rough Riders last won the CFL Grey Cup is former U.S. Vice President Richard Cheney.
Call me Dick, please.
All right, sir. Dick, please, can you comment on reports that earlier in your career you were inappropriately critical of Gordon Lightfoot?
Well, I'm inappropriately critical of almost everyone. That's how I operate. You might call it a management approach.
Well, fair enough. Let's take a call from Mary Elizabeth in Saskatoon.
Hello. Just a quick question about your many hospital stays, sir, please.
All right.
Paper slippers or flip-flops?
Let's veer a bit closer to the mark with our panel. Russ McKenzie, columnist for the Globe and Mail, lead us off here, please.
Well, I'm sorry. I just can't countenance being on the same platform with a war criminal. Good night, Nash. Mr. Vice President, you are under citizen's arrest.
Ow!
My goodness, he threw a teabag right in your face. Are you all right?
I guess so. It was cold.
Well, I do apologize, sir. There's never an excuse for cold tea.
You know what, Crawford? Why don't we just cancel any TV, have a 50 Israeli security folks at the book signing, and leave it at that?
Well, I'm afraid that's outside the promotional budget for the book, sir. I mean, let's face it, you weren't Vice President of Canada.
Yeah. Ain't that the pity? Okay, pal. Let's Red X the whole tour.
Oh, really, sir? We had a near commitment for you to emcee the miniature donkey showcase at the Calgary Stampede. It's... That was a lovely vase.
Get out of here before I blow my schnoz on your pocket square.
Yes, sir.
Owen Crawford.
Yes, Mr. Vice President?
Tell him it was nothing personal about Gordon Lightfoot.
I certainly will, sir.
In all fairness, the new conservative government up there has done some good things. I particularly admire the new slogan they've adopted. Canada, it's not just for peacekeeping anymore. Maybe next book. And a partial diary for the Ides of March 2012. Sincerely yours, Dick Cheney,
Confidential. 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 Confidential.
Okay, kids, take the party outside. And now, ladies and gentlemen.
He's not a general. He commands no troops. He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an inspector general.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, employees at major banks who churned out fraudulent foreclosure documents, forged signatures, made up fake job titles, and falsely notarized paperwork often did so at the behest of their superiors, according to the Inspector General of the Department of Housing and Urban Development in a report released this week, more than a month after the mortgage foreclosure settlement was announced. So announce the settlement first, then release the results of the investigation afterward. It's been well documented that the nation's biggest banks routinely robo-signed legal papers, but the new report from the HUD IG reveals that those shoddy practices often came at the directions of bank managers and that employees in some cases were judged by how fast they could get new foreclosure filings out the door. I believe the reports we just released will leave the reader asking one question: how could so many people have participated in this misconduct, says the IG David Montoya. The answer: simple greed. It's not the product, it's greed. I believe I would correct him in only one. It's complicated greed. HUD investigators launched their inquiry soon after news of the bank's practices caused a national uproar in late 2010. It reviewed foreclosure practices at Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, and Ally. Those were all involved in the recent settlement. They issued subpoenas, pored over personnel files. By the way, pored is spelled without an O, all you folks on Twitter. Repeatedly, according to the report, investigators were hampered by poor record-keeping at the banks. Yeah, you could get away with that if the bank wanted you to prove something. I'm a poor record keeper, Mr. B of A. Sluggish responses to requests for documents and an unwillingness to make employees available for interviews or to allow them to answer detailed questions. Nonetheless, investigators pieced together a picture of a deeply flawed system riddled with errors, where employees often had little or no training, where managers encouraged wrongdoing, and where haste trumped all else. At Bank of America, performance reviews revealed employees were judged on how quickly they worked and how many files they churned through. One manager noted in an employee review, it's all about stats, affidavits per hour. In addition, supervisors said in interviews with HUD officials they often signed affidavits as an assistant secretary or vice president of Chase when those were not their official titles. They were given those titles by Chase for the sole purpose of allowing them to sign legal documents. This is all familiar if you heard Eve Smith's first and second interviews, actually first interview on the subject of the foreclosure mess, but now it's coming from the Inspector General of HUD. In one review of 36 filings, Chase was able to provide documents showing the amount the borrowers presumably owed in only 4 of the cases. Of those, 3 were inaccurate. Bank of Opportunity. At Citigroup, some employees told investigators they signed as many as 200 documents a day, and the numbers grew over time. These are documents they're supposed to attest that they've read and can attest that they are familiar with the truthfulness of thereof. Citigroup says it strengthened the way it processes foreclosures. News of the Inspectors General, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Now, in the waning moments, as you think about the and there will be next week a longer piece from the American Banker in our trade segment about more of that stuff. But now, as you think about the controversy surrounding This American Life, let me focus you on one word that's at the heart of much of what goes on in public radio. It's called storytelling. And from Current, the trade publication of public broadcasting, I'll read it for you. On a fledgling classical music service for public radio stations, there's a long-standing debate about modal music research in public radio, pioneered by Colorado Public Radio, which shares the research results with stations who pay for it. Modal is a method of selecting music based not on genre or composer, but on sounds or modes preferred by focus group participants. It generally results in music that's easy on the ears. Defenders say modal music is misunderstood, that all it does is tell programmers what music their target audience prefers. And that format being prepared some time ago was also reliant on framing the music with storytelling. And last year in Spokane, Washington, a new public radio station began piloting terrestrial broadcasts of remix radio, mainlining driveway moments, first-person stories, from the Public Radio Library. It's all about storytelling. Sometimes they're true. I do a monologue about a classical music composer. It might be good for that format. Not a real plan, just a thought that occurs to me when I read the trades for you. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Oh, just time for one item from outside the bubble. Pope Benedict has ordered a custom blended eau de cologne just for him. The fragrance mixes hints of lime tree, verbena, and grass. It was concocted by the Italian perfume maker Silvania Casoli, who has previously created scents for Madonna and Sting. That from The Guardian of London. And with, you know, but you, no, you can't get it. You cannot smell like the Pope. It's only for him. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, we close this edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the East Coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ 7.490 megahertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin. Around the world via the internet at two locations, live and archived, whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available for your smartphone through stitcher.com and available as a free podcast through kcrw.com. And it would be just like getting to smell like the Pope if you'd agree to join me then, would you? All righty, thank you very much. A tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halston, and thanks to Jenny Lawson here at WWNO-FM in New Orleans for helping to get the victory on the lease and for helping to make today's show possible. The email address for this broadcast and the playlist of the music featured on it, part of the Rondelay of Delights, available for you at harryshearer.com. And this broadcast is on Twitter. Join the almost 58,000 followers, and I do mean followers, at the Harry Shearer. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from New Orleans. Happy St. Joseph's Day.